My guest today, Grant Smith, is the director of the Washington-based IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, which focuses on exposing the hidden history of U.S.-Israel relations and the role of pernicious influence that the Israel lobby over U.S. Middle East policies and the entire American political process, interests that I happen to share. He's the author of two unofficial histories of AIPAC, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government, and Foreign Agents, AIPAC from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, as well as the books Divert, Spy Trade, Deadly Dogma, Visa Denied, and editor of the book Neocon Middle East Policy. His latest book, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, published earlier this year, by which I last interviewed him, provides the details about the extraordinary network of organizations that make up what is commonly known as the Israel pro-Israel lobby, a couple of which I spoke about earlier. On that note, I'd like to welcome Grant Smith once again to Takes on the World.
Hey, Jeffrey, thanks a lot for having me on again.
Well, you are the man, and when it comes to this issue, and unfortunately, it is one that is covered up by not only the mainstream media, but mostly alternative media to our country's detriment and to those of Palestinians under Israel's occupation. We scheduled this interview before the election, in which a Clinton victory was widely anticipated. Now, although we appear to be entering an era where chaos and unpredictability seem to be a new norm, one thing is likely to remain the same, and that is America's unconditional support for Israel. You're right in the belly of the beast. How do you see it so far?
Well, I see it as really throwing kind of a wrench into predictability. You know, again, everyone is assuming Hillary Clinton would win. But I don't think that the core Israel lobby asks are changing that much. And we can talk a lot about these, but I just wanted to throw some of them out. I think the drive for there to be more secrecy in U.S.-Israel relations, the return to the so-called no-daylight policy, is already underway, and it would have been underway under a Clinton administration as well. I think the Clinton administration probably would have been more committed to restarting a peace process to give the appearance of doing something. And I believe that the Trump administration is probably less inclined to even bother. In terms of the foreign aid that you were talking about in your intro, I think either candidate would have been very much inclined to boost aid above what was signed off in on September 14 in the Memorandum of Understanding to put it more in line with the benchmark level of activity within the Israel lobby, which raises $6 to $10 billion per year. So, aid to Israel has always sort of followed that as almost a matching grant, and I think we're going to see a doubling at least under a Trump administration. I think there'll be a real drive to overturn the Iran deal, the so-called JCPOA. Could have happened under Clinton as well. Really going to be a big drive to move the embassy, as you were talking about, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and really make the U.S. tell the rest of the world that this is Israel's undivided capital and throw away the whole two-state solution, which you noted AIPAC has already done. Enter Israel into the U.S. visa waiver program so that any Israeli can come into the U.S. without a visa. That's been something that almost passed a while back. Harder line policies against Russia, protecting Israel's Middle East nuclear monopoly by really buttressing the gag order that tells all government officials and contractors they can't talk about Israel's nuclear weapons. No meaningful moves against settlement building certainly is what Clinton would have done. Trump, as you noted, has already really voiced approval for them. And, you know, at the policy level, you know, fewer and fewer IRS reporting requirements about what the Israel lobby's up to, whether it's FIDF, as you talked about, or the huge multi-billion transfers that go from the U.S. to Israel counterparts, which are already, they're really not supervised in any way. It's all self-regulated. But I think we're going to see even less reporting requirements because many in the lobby just don't like reporting what they're up to and have moved away from transparency as nonprofits. And U.S. pressure on Lebanon with, as you noted a couple shows back, has an increased Hezbollah presence in government. So, you know, that's what I see as policy, and I hope we can drill down on why the Democrats and Republicans are approached differently by Israel lobby programs to get them to be supportive, because I think they're kind of mirror images in that they're different in the way they're approached.
Well, it's like almost taken for granted, or was until a few years ago, that the Democratic Party was solidly, the base was behind Israel. But
right.
In 2012, when they had that ridiculous vote, revote three times on whether to add recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, to the Democratic Party platform, and Antonio Villaraigosa, the California, Los Angeles mayor who was chairing the meeting, had asked three times for a vote, and when it was clearly overwhelming, was defeated, not overwhelming, but defeated, clearly defeated, he announced that it had passed. And that
right.
kind of, and that was the message. The Republicans started using that to go and woo Jewish voters and Jewish donors particularly.
Right.
But we saw in the platform committee that even U.S. policy that was supporting, was opposing expansion of the settlements and criticizing Israel's occupation, even recognizing occupation, could not pass the platform committee, which was then, we were told, was the most progressive platform, Democratic platform since FBR. Why don't you comment on what happened within that, the Democratic Party, and where it stands now in terms of relationship to Israel?
Sure. Well, you had a move. Bernie Sanders managed to include people like James Zogby and Maya Berry and you know, Cornel West in the platform committee to voice support for, you know, expressing that Palestinian rights mattered and that the U.S. should be much more conscious of this as a conflict generator. And, you know, they, of course, have stature, and they have the votes ideologically of the base of the Democratic Party and progressives that were pushing Bernie Sanders, but they were steamrolled in the platform committee. There's just this sort of almost tragic voting down by operatives of every single proposal they made to mitigate and inject peace and justice-oriented resolutions into the platform. So they were steamrolled every bit as much as in 2012 when there was a floor vote for an AIPAC-generated plank that would declare an undivided Jerusalem as being, you know, the Democratic Party's platform. But you know, this is you have to admit, or at least analyze the fact that by abandoning the base, the Democratic Party really probably set itself up for defeat. And of course, it's probably too early to say that definitively. But Shibli Telhami was sounding an alarm bell in a poll that he released before the election, saying that 59% of Democrats thought aid was too much or way too much, and that 53% of Democrats thought that the Israeli government had too much influence in the U.S. And so Shibli Telhami, who's a mainstream pollster, you know, sounding the alarm bell that the party's probably not going to be excited by the Hillary Clinton move to either suppress debate or at least not follow the majority of Democrats who believe that this is a problem, probably helped her lose. And we should definitely talk about the Republican Party in terms of the evangelical vote that turned out for Donald Trump and how different it really is in terms of fundraising. There's a fascinating video by Stephanie Sirach, who was a Democratic Party fundraiser. She's now with Emily's List. But she basically talked about how when she was raising money for up to 50 federal candidates for the Democratic Party per year, she would send out an Israel policy paper crafted in conjunction with the AIPAC coordinator for each state nationwide for the candidate, just to get them the startup money that they needed to hire a campaign director and even put together a staff. So she was basically, as she admits in the video, establishing this operating system, which would then run all of the other programs proposed by these Democratic candidates for office. And it was just baked in that they were, you know, she had to notify some of the candidates about their pro-Israel paper and say this, and she says in the video, this is the way we get the money. So this beholden relationship on the Israel issue is totally baked into Democratic Party fundraising.
Now, we mentioned that you're talking about the Christian evangelicals.
Right.
This is one of the reasons that I frankly believe that Trump will go ahead and appoint someone like Huckabee, which to be the ambassador, or some very pro-Israel, obviously pro-Israel person, and that if he calls, if he actually announces early on that Jerusalem, we're recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, this will be so welcome by the Christian evangelicals that they will overlook other promises that he's not going to fulfill. And also the Orthodox Jews, as opposed to secular Jews, Orthodox in this country and in Israel, were very strong supporters of Trump. And should he make Israel or Jerusalem announced as the new capital, he will get a lot of bonus points and money. Not that he needs money, but political support that he's going to need because he's already backtracking on a number of issues. What do you think about that?
I think you're right. I think it would electrify the Christian evangelicals. Ralph Reed is apoplectic, the former head of the Moral Majority, saying this is probably the best thing that has ever happened. Trump, as you know, formed in June or July in the Israel Advisory Committee with advisors who were lawyers, one over was in the Trump Organization. But basically, they issued directives saying, we're not attached to a two-state solution. There's not going to be any limit by the MOU on aid. And, you know, it looks as though they're going to weaponize the Justice Department against any sort of BDS or college pro-Palestinian activism if they manage to get Jeff Sessions in there, or even if they don't. So the idea that Huckabee could be the ambassador, the next ambassador to Israel, and that they'll move quickly to satisfy this resolution you were talking about that requires the president to basically say no to it, probably not going to sign that, and they'll probably do it and then tell the rest of the world that this is what's in the best interest for global peace and to just buck up and do it, because Trump did win 81% of the white evangelical Christian vote, according to some exit polls, and this is an 80 adult voter contingent in the U.S. that has been constantly courted by Israel affinity organizations since the 1960s. They do vote on a lot of these issues, but, you know, mainly anti-abortion. They're very much voting on their feelings for Israel as a dispensationalist narrative where, you know, Jesus Christ will return and that they've got to do everything they can to support Israel for that reason. But they've been built up with a lot of seed funding from Israel affinity organization donors, such as Christians United for Israel and the other one that you mentioned, funding FIDF, just kind of putting in some money into the tip jar to get things rolling. That's another big fundraising machine, although in a sense the Christian evangelical Israel affinity organizations are completely a non-entity in terms of the total pie, which I mentioned is headed for $6 billion and being the U.S.'s largest charity in the 501c3 section by the end of 2020. So I don't think he could have won without this support. He couldn't have won without hitting some of these hot-button issues. And again, according to Telhami's poll, 40% of the Republican side believes that Israel aid is way too little, and only 27% said Israel exercises too much influence in the U.S. 73%, according to Telhami, of the Republicans believe that the U.S. should do nothing or limit its opposition to settlement building, and that's exactly what Trump has signaled.
A very bright future. This is not surprising, and one of the features of the $38 billion record-breaking gift, memorandum of understanding that Obama gave to Israel for over a decade, that's $3.8 billion, was a promise from Israel. It's amazing. that that Netanyahu, who was ever prime minister, although Netanyahu seems to be perennial in that job for life, will not come back and ask the U.S. Congress to go around the president as other prime ministers had done before. There's been a whole history of Congress giving more money than even pro-Israel presidents have wanted to give to Israel. And under this understanding, Israel will not come back and ask Congress for more money. They had actually wanted $45 or $50 billion. And it was amazing. Even two former liberal so-called opposition candidates to Netanyahu, Moshe Yaalon, former defense minister, and I forget the other one, Ehud Barak, former prime minister, wrote articles said that the $38 billion was not enough. They should have gotten more and criticized Netanyahu for not getting more. It's extraordinary what they expect. This is talk about entitlements. You know, the Republican congressman criticized Americans who have put money into Social Security and expect something for it as an entitlement that should be cut or minimized. But Israel's put nothing into the United States except their hands in American taxpayers' pockets.
Well, this MOU, I think the first thing we need to be clear about is we're saying all of this based on what the White House says is in it. It could be up to 700 pages. We've asked for it under the Freedom of Information Act. We can't get it. We can't even get the Bush administration's MOU with Israel, which is expiring. So, you know, this is what they say. They say that they can't come back to Congress. They say that this is the limit. They say that, you know, unless there's a war, which almost incentivizes war, that the U.S. won't break these limits. But this is an executive agreement that was designed to guarantee support to Israel. It's one-sided in the sense that there don't seem to be any pledges by Israel to do anything for the United States. But I think this agreement is a dead letter at this point. I think that the entire drive now, even on the Democratic Party side, would be to fall all over themselves in offering up to $6 to $10 billion a year, saying this simply isn't enough. Look at all of these threats, especially if they manage to ditch the JCPOA with Iran. They'll be able to say, look, Iran is still this major, major threat, and so Israel needs more support. So I think this letter was designed as a comfort letter, this MOU, and it was really designed to pledge a level of support to guarantee that, you know, this would at least be in place. But I think the Trump turnaround, which really began after the MOU was negotiated, means that this memorandum of understanding should be looked at as something that no longer applies, and that anything from $6 to $10 billion will be the new MOU signed by President Trump when he gets in office.
Yeah, obviously he'd be in a position to discard it and amend it, and who in Congress would be challenging him? Not a single member would.
Well, Congress, the Republican parties beyond that have already rejected the idea that the president can limit what Congress wants to give to Israel of its own volition, you know, powered by this incentives network called political campaign contributions. They've already rejected that, especially Leslie Graham.
Lindsey Graham from South Carolina.
Lindsey Graham,
sorry. Right. I remember his questioning of Chuck Hagel when Hagel was up for defense secretary, quote unquote defense secretary. It had more to do with Israel than it had to do with American defense.
Right.
And obviously the new defense secretary seems like to be like a robot. He does whatever Washington wants him to do, and as aggressive as possibly can be. What's called Ash Carter. He might even be kept. Well, he's not going to be kept on. What is interesting about President Trump? By the way, I'm talking with Grant Smith of Institute for Research Middle East Policy. We're talking about Trump and Israel and what's happening there. One of his prospective appointees, General Mattis, who's been spoken of as a prospective head of the quote-unquote Defense Department. Mattis, while he was the head of Central Command in the Middle East, wrote a memo or made a talk in which he said that Israel is a problem for the United States because Israel's occupation of Palestinian land creates problems for American soldiers and American bases in the Middle East, which is also what General Petraeus had said to a Senate committee before he backtracked on that. So it's interesting. I have not seen that statement, which is a matter of record found on the Internet, brought up at all by the mainstream media in discussing General Mattis. And also Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, was the one who outed both Clinton and Obama as pushing for the setting up of an Islamic State in Syria before it actually took place. And that he was interviewed on Al Jazeera about that, which I even mentioned on my radio program. So it's really ironic. He's actually wants to defeat the Islamic State and thinks it's a mistake to go after Bashar Assad. So there's a lot of strange things going on. And of course, people change their policies to accommodate their job positions in Washington, as we know. But you have, maybe you have some comments about that.
Yeah, I think whether, just from the 20,000-foot view, whether he disregards the MOU or appoints some of these critics who outed these issues, I would see that as more of a backhand against the Obama legacy and the Clintons, and possibly, you know, just trial balloons. But, you know, the whole political appointees that are going to be willing to, you know, work with the Israel program is going to be critical because, you know, essentially that is going to be the demand. The demand is going to be pro-Israel Secretary of State, pro-Israel Department of Defense, no daylight ever, that this Obama administration view that sometimes there has to be daylight, you know, just because the Israelis don't move on anything, more pro-Israel national security advisors, U.S. Treasury, IRS, even Supreme Court appointees, so that when the next Zivotofsky case comes up saying that people born in Jerusalem should have Israel and their passport. All of these things are extremely important to the Israel program, and whether there's a resurgence even of neocon clash of the civilizations type dogma, you know, we await that because that is certainly what the many proponents within the Israel lobby want. They want the United States to consider what's going on in the Middle East as a clash of civilization where these recalcitrant, inherently violent, and, you know, no redeeming quality Islamic movements are the mortal enemy of the United States. And, you know, to keep that theme going and building that this is the new Soviet threat, along with Russia as a new Soviet threat or Soviet II, those are going to be major, major drives in terms of appointing people who think that way. So, you know, I think that's going to be, you know, as we see these names coming out, Rudy Giuliani, you know, he did an interview with the Wall Street Journal, and it's sort of revealed how utterly unqualified he would be as Secretary of State. But if he did manage to get a major role, either as Secretary of State or even AG, if Jeff Sessions isn't going to be there, you know, it would really signal that somebody who brings all of this with him is coming in and going to clean house. And boy, if you're a campus activist, you better watch out.
Well, already there are at least 14 states that have made BDS against the law. I mean, overwhelming votes, 60-0 in the assembly in California, 47-1, I think it was in Michigan. You've also mentioned and borne out in Big Israel, your book on the Israel lobby. You can see how these organizations play politically on every level. So what happens in Washington with Congress is reproduced in almost every state in the country when it comes to Israel. It's like Israel is seen as a strategic asset by some state in which it is not threatened at all by anyone.
Right.
But Israeli officials and Israeli businesses are welcome. And the idea that Americans can boycott Israel because of its treatment of the Palestinians is being against the law.
Right.
It's extraordinary.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there is legislation in the Congress sort of comparing BDS to the Arab boycott of doing business with Israel that was occurring back in the 70s, and really painting it as this harmful movement as opposed to free speech. But most people in any given state are completely unaware that within the large Jewish federations that are assigned to each metropolitan area, sometimes more than one in the case of Los Angeles, there's a small unincorporated unit called the JCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council, that's constantly lobbying the state legislature to pass pro-Israel resolutions, to change pension laws so that they can buy more Israel bonds, to do joint economic and scientific programs, so that when you talk about $3.8 billion of aid to Israel, that doesn't count any of these state-level activities. And just like the FIDF fundraiser, none of this stuff is well reported in any of the media. People don't know they exist. And it really follows the sort of original AIPAC model, where AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, was an unincorporated committee, just like its name states, inside a larger umbrella organization called the American Zionist Council, in which they do a lot of lobbying. They're completely under the radar. Nobody really knows what they're doing. They don't break out their financials. They don't want to declare any sort of lobbying activity, and for the most part don't, and get all of these mirror image resolutions and Iran boycotts and BDS anti-BDS campaigns passed at the state and local level that make anything like, passing a JCPOA with Iran extremely difficult for a president when he looks around and sees all these states have already passed anti-Iran-type deals that would prohibit trade or restoration of economic ties and all of these things at the state level. So it's a comprehensive program. Few people know about it, fewer understand it, and nobody is really in any position to oppose it at any meaningful level.
One might call it a shadow government.
Well, I call it augmented government.
Augmented, okay, it's safer.
You have the Anti-Defamation League, which is augmenting the efforts of the FBI and has been very active in getting political appointees to declare it that it's a partnership that has to have liaisons with each FBI office, and they try and work to promote their agenda. The American Jewish Committee, which augments the State Department to the point that you have State Department officials saying, oh, yeah, this is the State Department of the Jewish community, even though they're primarily not very representative of the entire Jewish community. And you have other augmentations in terms of, AIPAC augmenting congressional programs. So whether it's a shadow government or kind of a snap-on, or whether, you have these other sort of analogies for it, it's big, it's getting bigger, and again, if people don't know this, it's now the biggest charity, although I would acknowledge that most of it has no social welfare purpose, in America today. Bigger than the Red Cross, bigger than the Salvation Army.
It's extraordinary. Actually, go back for a moment. You mentioned the AIPAC was within the American Zionist Council. Yesterday was the anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, the who challenged Israel on several serious issues. One of being his effort to get American Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent as a result of the Fulbright hearings in 1963, which have also vanished down the memory hole and would have if it were not for your book about them.
Right.
Just briefly tell us about that, and then I also want to mention, before we go up, we only have about 10 minutes left, 9 minutes left, to talk about the illegality of U.S. aid to Israel.
Sure. Well, before the anniversary of Kennedy, we need to talk about the November 21st Robert F. Kennedy order to this umbrella lobbying group, the American Zionist Council, to begin registering as foreign agents of the Israeli government because they were taking in money from sort of this shadowy government in waiting that was assembled called the Jewish Agency offshore to kind of help set up Israel back from the 1920s on. They were receiving millions and millions of dollars to lobby Congress for aid and put in public relations campaigns, basically spending foreign money because they couldn't get domestic money sufficient to execute their program, a huge propaganda campaign. If people want to see a full review of this, they can go to YouTube and look at the impact, the Israel Lobby's Impact on America video, which was done a couple of weeks ago at St. Olaf University or St. Olaf College. But basically, they were ordered to register as foreign agents. Doing that, even though AIPAC was a committee already established within the AZC, they split off 6 weeks later and incorporated and quickly got tax-exempt status from friendly IRS commissioners who refused Fulbright's demand that they investigate a whole panoply of organizations that were lobbying for Israel in the U.S., many of them, again, receiving overseas contributions through stealth conduits that they unearthed during the Senate investigation. So that anniversary passed unnoticed. We tweeted out on 11/21, hey, this is the anniversary that AZC, including AIPAC, was ordered to register as an Israeli foreign agent. Nobody really even knows what that means because there's no historical consciousness of that. But you can't argue, and we have argued at the Justice Department, that this order was comprehensive and included AIPAC, which should be registering as an Israeli foreign agent even today. But Mortimer Kaplan and Sheldon Cohen, two IRS commissioners, basically heard Fulbright and said, no, we're not going to investigate, we're not going to revoke tax-exempt status, and quickly helped reestablish AIPAC as a major entity. And now they have more than 50 organizations in their umbrella, which is the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. So about the lawsuit that we filed in August, this is, as you mentioned in the intro, a suit challenging the legality of aid to Israel since it's a nuclear power. We've obtained many documents showing that, but under Symington and Glenn amendments, it's never been eligible for aid since those were passed, those modifications to the 1961 Foreign Assistance Agreement. Michelle Bennett is the defense attorney for the U.S. government, a serious defense attorney who's going to try to respond to this complaint on December 1. The time is short. Defendants are leaving office, and so we're attempting to get a declaration that the aid is, in fact, unlawful and talk about possible clawback of aid as a legal matter and responsibility to taxpayers within the U.S. federal court system. So people can read about that on IRMEP.org.
They could also go to an amazing trove of documents on the Israel Lobby on your archives, which is unparalleled anywhere. You've done such an incredible job of going after government, getting documents that I would say provide valuable tools for those who seriously criticize Israel and support Palestinian rights and also democracy in America, which is threatened, undermined by these organizations clearly, as is our media. The extraordinary thing is that if I did not have a Google alert going back for a long time for Friends of Israel Defense Forces, I wouldn't know about these events happening either.
That's very much under the radar. People don't know about it. If you say, what's the biggest charitable contribution of American social welfare organizations, they never guess that it's Israel. But people who really care about this should also think about coming to a conference called the Israel Lobby and American Policy Conference at the National Press Club on March 24. You can look for information about that just by Googling the Israel Lobby and American Policy. This is the fourth annual conference for people to come and talk to other people concerned about these issues and its impact on America, not just foreign policy, but day-to-day life. So I'd also just plug that as well.
Well,
and, of course,
that,
you've spoken at two of those, and you've seen the quality of speakers and people who come to that.
Right. And each time at the press club, they've had full houses.
It's
an extraordinary program. They get absolutely zero coverage in the U.S. media, and that includes Democracy Now! The alternative media is also guilty of looking the other way when it comes to Israel Lobby. The Nation magazine, this is the New Republic, this is a problem that has allowed this huge conglomerate to go under the radar. The idea that $38 million can be raised in a matter of a few minutes at the Beverly Hilton, and you have Robert De Niro, Arnold Schwarzenegger there, Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots. He's a patriot of Israel, not the United States. He's a major contributor to the Friends of Israel Defense Forces, built stadiums for Israelis over in Israel. A number of leading actors, actresses, they come and perform there. In New York, you have leading it. At one event, they had five former Israeli chiefs of staff and the current one being interviewed by video. That's news, not for the New York Times or any other mainstream newspaper. It's extraordinary. And one of the things, years ago, I was doing a story for a magazine called Lies of Our Times, which went out of business because they published my stories. And I was on aid to Israel, and I went back and found out the previous 8 years, I went back 8 years, there was not a single story in the U.S. media about aid to Israel. Right. There was foreign aid was mentioned, but the amount going to Israel was not mentioned, which proves to me that the idea that the American people support aid to Israel is a sham.
It's almost never polled. It's surprising that Shibli Telhami, who works at Brookings, was even allowed to do it, and that it even appeared in some mainstream media outlets. But it really does show the importance of creating media, and this show is certainly an example of that. Now, the mainstream would call it fake news, but a lot of people have pushed back and talked about, well, what about the war on terror propaganda that came through mainstream media? Was that not fake news? So there's a real transformation going on, but people who want to become a part of it should really read alternative media and articles and magazines such as the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and certainly takes on the world, and they have to be more active participants in informing themselves and not constantly being subjected to a lot of basically misinformation and disinformation. If most of them believed a couple of years back that Iran already had nuclear weapons, and now they know that they don't, they should ask themselves where they got that idea. And the majority of Americans did, in fact, in the run-up to the JCPOA, believe Iran had nuclear weapons. So it's a pretty poor state of affairs when you look at knowledge of the Middle East and the happiness with which mainstream media seems to be conducting a lot of these poor campaigns to cover these stories.
And I've suggested that what's going to happen 2017 in general is going to make 2016 look like a garden party.
Let's hope not. Let's hope not, Jeff. Please.
I hope not. My pessimism has preserved me for years. Otherwise, I would have walked away a long time ago. Grant Smith, IRMEP, www.irmep.org. Go to that website and you will find amazing things. And also, Grant has written a number of books I've spoken with him about here, and they're real eye-openers, and they don't get major reviews either for the same reason the IDF dinners don't get covered. Grant, thanks so much for being our guest on Takes on the World. Look forward to doing it again.
I really appreciate it, Jeff. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye now.
This is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.